39. The mask hung around Zero's neck. A dozen nicks and punctures covered the smooth flesh of his face, each one trailing blood. A red gash stretched across the space where his left eye should have been. He took a step toward them. His trip over the steering wheel had broken his arm in at least two places, possibly a few ribs too, the way his chest sagged on one side.
"You've been laughing at me my whole life," muttered Zero, taking another step. "Making my life hell. Not anymore."
"Zeke," said Eli, "we need to get you to a doctor. You've been..."
"Not anymore," roared Zero.
The skin around his jaw stretched tight and shook like a drum. His working arm swung up to grab at Eli. Eli smacked the arm away but numbed his hand in the process. It felt like stopping the casual swing of a baseball bat. Yet another sensation he knew, thanks to Zeke. He took a few steps back. Zero limped after him. With his swinging, twisted arm, it gave him the gait of a B-movie zombie.
"Turned everyone against me in school," snarled the faceless man. "Then, in the whole town. This is all your fault. They turned me into this because of you. To help them find you."
His fingers stretched out, flexed, and Eli had no doubt they could crush bone. He ducked and slammed into Zero. He drove his shoulder into the faceless man's gut and kicked at the ground. Zero slid back and crashed against the Hornet's wide fenders. The faceless man brought his arm down hard. Eli's back shuddered and the muscles on one side spasmed. The impact shook his spine and forced his eyes so wide they watered. He tried to keep Zero pinned against the car, but the pain crumpled his body, and he slid to his knees. Zero's head twitched just a moment before a rock hit him in the side of his jaw. He growled, more annoyed than hurt. Harry bent down, grabbed another egg-sized stone, and flung it. Zero reached out and caught it. His head never moved. He flicked the rock back at her, and it struck just under her chin. Harry dropped, wheezing, to her knees and grabbed at her throat. Eli gritted his teeth and straightened his back so he could stare at Zero's blank face. Blood soaked the sleeve of the faceless man's broken arm from biceps to wrist and dripped from his fingertips. Across one cheek, a purple bruise worked its way up from beneath the skin.
"No more," Zero whispered to Eli. "My whole life's messed up because of you."
Eli's hands dropped and his knuckles scraped something hard. His fingers explored and found its shape, Harry's first stone. Eli wrapped his fingers around it. Zero grabbed the front of Eli's shirt and dragged him to his feet. The motion took next to no effort, as if he were hefting a gym bag. The forest whirled and Eli slammed against the car. The Hornet's front end wrenched his back and set off another spasm. His hands flailed and he almost dropped the stone. His fingers pulled it close to his palm and tightened his grip.
"I'm the hero now," said Zero. "I'm going to take care of you and then your damned searcher girlfriend. And then..."
Harry's pistol came whipping into Eli's line of sight. Zero grabbed for it, but Eli's shirt held his fingers. The fabric tore, half a second too late, and the steel barrel caught the faceless man in the side of the head. Certainty let him dodge the pain, but not the actual attack.
"Fucking bitch!"
he roared. He shook the scraps of cotton twill from his hand and reached for Harry. Eli brought the rock up, ignoring the pain in his back as he twisted around. The stone smashed into Zero's temple, right across from where Harry's pistol had struck. Right where a walnut-sized chunk of gravel had hit Eli almost 16 years ago. He felt bone shift under the blow. Zero made a muffled, bubbling sound deep in his throat. His hand came back around, fingers wide, but the movement threw him off balance. He teetered for a moment. Harry pistol-whipped him again, cracking it across his temple. Zero made another gargling noise. His knees folded, and he collapsed to the ground, stretching out like a line between them. He twitched two more times and grew still. Eli glanced at her.
"Is he dead?"
"Maybe,"
She coughed twice, rubbed her throat, and watched the body.
He's not breathing.
Do they normally breathe?
I don't think so. No.
Eli bent his knees as slow as he could, but when he dropped, it still jarred his back. He fell to all fours and took a moment. Three deep breaths helped him calm the pain. Harry crouched next to him.
Are you okay?
I think so, he said. In the long run. Nothing a long hot bath and a dozen aspirin won't fix. Or a bottle of whiskey.
If we make it out of this, I'll see what I can arrange.
How about you?
She coughed again. It had a raspy edge.
I've been better, she said. But I'll be fine.
He reached out a cautious hand and pressed the fingers against Zero's neck. It took three tries to find a pulse.
Still alive. His pulse seems good, I guess. Steady, at least.
I can take care of that,
said Harry. The pistol spun in her hand. The grip came to rest against her palm and her fingers settled on the trigger.
Whoa, we can't kill him.
Why not?
He's a victim. They did this to him.
He replayed Zero's rant in his head.
They did this to him because of me.
Eli,
she said.
I think it's wonderful that you care so much about your childhood bully, but he's one of them now. He's a faceless man, and that means he's the enemy.
So we kill him and then what?
He waved his arm across the field to where the Model A sat. Do we have time to fix Eleanor's tire?
Doubtful, since we left the toolbox back with little you.
Damn it, he muttered. That's right. She looked at the Hornet.
Do you think we can get it free of the trees?
Eli frowned.
I don't think it's moving any sooner than Eleanor.
We'll have to steal a car.
He looked around.
I'm not sure there are any cars here. Yet.
A low growl rose up in the distance.
Excellent timing, Mr. Teague,
she sighed. She looked down at Zero, shook her head, and holstered the pistol.
Okay, he said. We can't get away through history. We can't get away on foot. Can we hide?
She shook her head.
Certainty. They'd know where we were as soon as they got close. No hiding, no disguising. We just can't be near.
Yeah?
She stared over at the Founder's house, just visible through the thin trees.
We're near them,
she said.
We're sometime around 1900, right under their noses.
What?
She rolled Zero over and reached into his coat. Eli watched her frisk the faceless man.
You looking for his pistol?
No,
she said, moving on to another pocket. She pulled out a notepad, tossed it aside, continued her search.
New plan. We're not going to look for the dream.
Harry held up her prize, Zero's badge.
We're going to go in there,
she said.
Right now, and we're going to steal it.
40. They ran across the field, away from the growling engine, through the gravel, and around the Founder's house. Spikes of pain jarred Eli's back with every step, but after a few minutes they'd calmed enough for him to run without help from Harry. The sprawling structure had two back entrances and a side entrance. Each was chained and locked. In his gut, Eli already knew the only way in was through the front door. At the base of the broad stairs, Harry pushed the badge into his hand.
You hold it,
she said.
Why?
She shrugged.
Faceless men, not faceless women.
Do you really think it matters? Do you really think it doesn't?
He wrapped his fingers around the badge and they headed up the steps. At the first landing, the dread hit. The childhood nervousness and confusion in the pit of his stomach. The feeling of being watched. He stumbled to a halt. Harry took another step and did the same. She glanced at him with worried eyes.
You too?
He nodded. The growl of the big engine echoed across the town. They ran up to the next landing, stumbled again, then hit the top of the staircase, almost 50 feet above the road. Eli looked for a Hudson Hornet and was stunned for a moment by the view he had of Sanders. He could see the roof of the Silver Arrow, the fabric store just past it, the movie theater. Harry shook the door. One of the small glass panels rattled. She brought her boot up and slammed her heel beneath the knob. On the third kick, the wood splintered. It tore free on the fourth, and glass shattered as the door slammed back against the inside wall. She grabbed Eli's arm and dragged them inside. A few sheet-covered chairs slouched around the first room of the Founder's house. An impressive fireplace stood at the far end, swept clean of all signs of an actual fire. A long, barren counter stretched off to the left, and an American flag stood next to it. Eli had seen many rooms like this as a teen, closed down for the winter until what little tourist trade Sanders had came back.
"Here,"
said Harry. She'd found a set of double doors leading away from the lobby. They were half glass, and Eli could see color and light beyond them. They each grabbed a handle and swung the doors open. They speedwalked down a long hallway with patterned carpet and waist-high molding. A chill hung in the hall, like an overpowered air conditioner. Wall sconces provided light, and between them hung small portraits of men in colonial clothes like Harry's. Eli saw Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and someone who might have been Thomas Jefferson, but he didn't recognize most of the ones he got a good look at. He glanced back over his shoulder and saw the distant patch of sunlight that marked the lobby.
"How long do you think this hallway is?"
Harry looked back, then ahead.
50, maybe 60 yards, why?
Eli shook his head. He fumbled with the badge. On television, police and FBI agents made flicking it open look so casual. He couldn't figure out how to brace his fingers across the leather panels to expose the oval disc of silver and gold. Words stretched across it, but in the uneven light of the sconces, they either made sense or looked like a jumble of Latin. In the dimmest parts of the hall, they could have been Egyptian pictographs.
"Do you know how this thing works?"
"It makes people see what the holder..."
"Yeah, but how? Do I just hold it, or is there a code word or a spell or something?"
She frowned.
"I don't know."
They passed a double door with big steel push plates and large windows honeycombed with wire. It would have looked more at home in a school or hospital. Through it, Eli glimpsed a long, tiled hallway. The main hallway came to an end at a set of wooden doors carved with intricate reliefs and scrollwork. Eli couldn't focus on any one element through all the thick detail. Above the doors, a Latin phrase had been carved with just as much skill and precision.
Ab initio.
Harry grabbed his free hand. Her grip made the bones of his palm ache.
"Ready?"
Eli nodded, took a deep breath, and held up the badge. They pushed open the ornate doors and marched into the cathedral chamber on the other side. Desks sat in endless rows, as did wooden and metal file cabinets, the ultimate open-plan office. Standing maps, much like John Henry's, appeared here and there. Eli's gaze followed the maps up and found chandeliers the size of swimming pools and a spiderweb of clear pipes suspended above it all. As he stared, something whizzed through one of the pneumatic tubes and vanished into the distance. Harry squeezed his hand and they stepped away from the doors deeper into the room. Eli's gaze drifted back to ground level in time to pass a broad table covered with a huge map. The people around the table moved small models and tokens with long sticks. Not people, he realized. Faceless men. They sat at desks and stood by maps and gathered in small clusters with file folders and loose papers. Some wore shirt sleeves and suspenders, others had suit coats and vests. Eli saw short, wide ties and long, narrow ones. He saw a few wearing tall boots and long, dark frocks like Harry's. None of them had masks, just blank ovals of flesh, not even the weak illusion of identity here. He'd expected a few dozen faceless men, a platoon or squadron or something, not hundreds, maybe thousands. Could there be a faceless man for every searcher? Did Harry have it backward? How many others, supposedly dead, had been converted into faceless men? Ones from chains that didn't involve her or Porter? Harry's hand tightened around his. Eli's fingers stiffened around the badge. He lifted it, placing it between them and the room. A faceless man in a long coat and top hat walked by them without reacting. Another one stepped around them, barely registering them as he did. Two walked by side by side and didn't acknowledge them at all.
It works, he murmured.
Stating the obvious,
she whispered back. They walked forward blindly, farther into the throng, hands tight and shoulders pressed together. Faceless men passed in front of them, walked alongside them, watched them go by. Harry's fingers tightened around his.
Hey, Nimrod!
Someone shouted. Eli's neck stiffened and the edges of the leather badge case bit his fingers as they clenched around it. His pace stumbled and Harry dragged him along.
What?
She whispered, studying his face. He turned his head.
I think they found us.
A clearing formed in the swarm of faceless men. An open space they all walked around and avoided. Eli and Harry meandered along the edge of it. A few yards away stood a pair of faceless men flanking a wheelchair. Strapped into the wheelchair was a man. A normal man. In a Sanders police uniform.
Zeke, murmured Eli.
Abraham,
muttered Harry.
That was me,
said a faceless man on the other side of the clearing. Eli recognized that voice, too. He fought the urge to turn and look.
Damn straight it was, moron,
snarled Zeke.
Hitting a guy in a wheelchair? What the fuck's wrong with you? Watch where you're going.
Harry tightened her grip and pulled. He glanced at the knot of faceless men once more, and then let her lead him back into the crowd. He stepped up to her side and held the badge out in front of them. A faceless man at a desk turned his head to them as they walked past, then returned his attention to his paperwork. Eli looked back as they passed a long cabinet of pigeonholes stuffed with envelopes. The far wall had almost vanished in the dim light. It had to be close to half a mile away.
Wait, he said.
Harry took another two steps before she stopped.
What?
He looked back again, then leaned in close to her.
We've been walking pretty much in a straight line from the lobby.
She nodded.
That first hallway, the main hall, was about 50 yards. And this room's gotta be almost 1,000 feet across, maybe more.
She glanced around them.
Yes?
Eli looked at the room.
The founder's house isn't that big, he said. If we've walked a quarter mile, we should be out the back door and somewhere in the baseball field. We might even be past the first base line.
I don't mean to sound shallow,
she murmured,
but at the moment my greater concern is being noticed and shot in the head.
Okay, yeah.
He glanced around the huge room.
Where should we be going?
What?
Where's the dream supposed to be, normally?
Harry blinked.
Why are you asking me?
I thought you knew where we're going.
I don't know. I've been following you.
What?
A faceless man turned his blank skull to them as he walked by. Eli held the badge a little higher and the agent continued on without pausing. Other faceless men stepped out of the way without hesitation, never turning or even registering them. A few turned their heads as Harry and Eli passed, but overall he sensed they had more important things to do. Harry tugged on his hand and got them moving again. She muttered in his ear as they passed under a chandelier.
Why would you think I'd know?
I thought there'd be some stories or something, said Eli. You've got a story for everything about this.
Nobody's ever been in here before,
she said.
At least nobody who ever came out.
Okay, he said. Okay, let's think this through. Where would it be? Where do you put the most valuable thing in the country to protect it?
In a safe? A vault?
Maybe, but where?
A gaunt, faceless man looked up as they walked past his desk. He followed them with his blank features. Eli shot a quick glance back over his shoulder. The figure was still focused on them.
You're holding the badge too high,
whispered Harry.
It's attracting attention.
We'll attract more attention if I put it down.
You don't know that.
15 always held it up high, said Eli. I don't think he did it to look cool.
They walked past file cabinets and rows of desks and more faceless men.
Perhaps we should head back to the edge of the room,
murmured Harry.
There might be a sign or a map, and we wouldn't be at the center of things.
Eli's fingers tingled. He tried to flex them, and a spasm slid up his ring finger, stiffening it. The badge almost slipped away, and he twisted his hand around to catch it.
Careful,
muttered Harry. He felt another pinprick. not from his fingers. Eli turned the leather case to look at the badge. The letters shimmered across the gold and silver surface. It felt like static electricity racing across his hand.
"I think we're running out of time," he said.
"What?"
"The badge, I think it's rejecting me or something."
Harry scowled.
"The ones chasing us must have found Zero."
Eli looked at the dozens of faceless men around them.
"How long do we have?"
"I don't know."
"How long did it take when they shut Porter's off?"
"I don't know,"
she snapped.
"I thought we'd have more time, closer to the dream. That they wouldn't think we'd..."
Her eyes got wide.
"What?"
"Look around,"
she said.
"Look as far as you can see at the distant ones."
"What am I looking for?"
"The dream affects time,"
she said.
"It flows differently as we get closer to it."
He nodded.
"Right."
She studied the crowd.
"Look for the faceless men who are moving slower."
Eli felt his own eyes go wide. He looked down the rows of desks and cabinets, the aisles created by corkboards and pneumatic tubes. There were hundreds of faceless men, all in suits, all in motion, filing, processing, marching from place to place. Trying to pick one out to look for a particular detail was like a childhood puzzle. Find the difference between these two. A few hundred yards away, off to his left, a faceless man closed a file folder and moved it to a bin on the corner of his desk. His arm swung in a graceful, steady arc. He released the folder, and it drifted down into the bin. Eli's heart beat twice while the file dropped.
"There," he said. "That way."
"Are you sure?"
The badge prickled his fingers again. "Sure enough." They headed down the row. Eli pushed the badge across his body, keeping it close to Harry. Three faceless men passed by, each holding a clear mask in their hands. One was a clown's face, another looked like some kind of animal, maybe a fox or wolf. The third turned his head to study Eli and Harry. A wall loomed up ahead, the far side of the room. Eli could see some kind of arch or doorway there.
"Hello, Mr. Teague,"
a voice called out behind them.
"Mrs. Pritchard, that is you, yes?"
Every faceless man around them straightened up from desks, reports, and conversations, their heads turning to focus on the two searchers. Harry's fingers tightened on Eli's and pulled him into a run. Blank skulls swung to follow them. They dodged between suited figures and grasping hands and reached the far wall. Molding wrapped the archway there, and heavy curtains hung behind it like a small stage. They'd been tied off to each side, revealing a staircase of white marble. It would have fit very well in a big courthouse or capitol building. A shot rang out, and one of the curtains rippled. They ran up the stairs blind, their shoes hitting each step with a whap. Harry raced ahead. Eli struggled to keep up and took some small relief in seeing the top of the stairs only 30 or 40 feet above. Another gunshot echoed in the marble stairway. Harry shouted and grabbed at her leg. She stumbled off the top step and into the room by the landing. Eli ran to join her. The room at the top of the stairs had marble floors and walls. A massive set of doors dominated one side of it. Eli didn't see any other furniture or decoration or light sources, even though midday brilliance filled the room. Harry sprawled a few feet from the stairs. Her pants were bloody, but not so much that it leaked down to the floor.
"Just grazed me,"
she said through clenched teeth. "Can you walk?"
"Possibly."
Footsteps echoed up the stairwell. Lots of them, in perfect sync. Harry let go of her leg and grabbed for her pistols.
"No, give them to me,"
said Eli, shoving the badge into his jeans.
"You can barely stand."
The Colts spun in her palms and stopped with the grips to him.
"Have you ever even fired a gun before?"
"Nope."
He aimed at the stairwell and squeezed both triggers at once. The pistols bucked in his hands and he heard a crack of metal on stone over the echo of the gunshots. The footsteps stopped. He squeezed off two more rounds with each pistol. The noise echoed in the room. One of the rounds sparked in the stairwell and left a black mark on the wall.
"Hello, Mr. Teague,"
said a voice. 15.
"I see you have weapons now."
Eli answered with a few more shots. The footsteps retreated, quickly, unevenly.
"What's going on?"
whispered Harry. He leaned back to her.
"I don't know," he murmured back. You keep saying they can dodge, they can't miss, but they haven't been able to shoot us.
They just shot me,
she whispered through clenched teeth.
You were just in the hospital 4 days ago.
But they didn't kill us. She rolled her eyes and pushed herself up the wall to her feet. Eli studied the doors on the far side of the room. They had to be close to 10 feet tall, and each one wider than he was tall. The clean, elegant panels held a round disc of brass, which stretched between the two doors, and a simple, old-fashioned keyhole sat at the center, right on the hairline seam between the doors. At the top and bottom, 4 brass sliders locked the doors in position. He peered a little closer. The doors didn't seem to be made of wood, but they also didn't look like metal. After a few minutes of staring, it almost seemed like the door was painted on the wall, like an elaborate Wile E. Coyote work of art. The longer he looked, the less sure he felt about the material. A sound came from the stairwell. He turned and squeezed the triggers 2 or 3 times each. The faceless man standing there flung himself back. The noise of shuffling, sliding, falling bodies echoed up to them.
Mr. Teague, called 15. His voice echoed up the steps. What do you think this will gain you? There's no way out of the rotunda except past us.
We don't have a lot of time,
said Harry. Eli studied the doors.
I know. Or a lot of ammunition.
Surrender now, 15 said, and I promise your execution will be swift and painless.
Eli looked at the lock.
Any ideas?
She shrugged.
If I had my toolbox, there's a lockpick set in it, but I have a feeling they wouldn't work.
He reached out, brushed the lock, and felt a hum of power travel through his arm and down to the floor. His fingers jumped back, then reached out again. It reminded him of a low-level electric shock conducted down to the... not to the floor. He handed one of the pistols back to Harry and felt the square badge case buzzing against his thigh. He fumbled it out, flipped it open. A gold and silver key sat in the leather case. One end was a heavy disc covered with more shifting letters and symbols. Its long neck ended in 3 simple teeth, the kind of thing used to open a cartoon jail cell. Harry fired off 4 precise shots at the stairwell, one after another. On the 4th, the slide of her Colt locked back. She released it, dropped the weapon into its holster, and plucked the other pistol from Eli's hands.
Whatever you plan on doing,
she said,
now would be an excellent time for it.
Hey, this heist was all your idea. Eli pulled the key from the case and slid it into the lock. It twitched between his fingers and then grew rigid, as if something had clamped down on it. I think it's... The key lunged an inch deeper into the lock, spun around twice, and then sank in up to its disc. It rotated one more time, then vanished into the lock. Harry pulled the trigger twice, then twice again. She holstered the pistol.
We just need to get to the dream, she said. We know whoever stole the dream got away without a trace.
Fingers crossed, said Eli. The brass sliders at the top and bottom of each door retracted, vanishing into the doorframe. The seam between the two doors darkened and widened. The keyhole swelled with it and came apart, just an odd ripple on the edge of either door. Eli looked for some sort of lock mechanism as the doors opened wider, but saw nothing other than smooth whatever the doors were made of. The gap stretched to 1 foot wide, then 2. Harry put a hand on Eli's shoulder and pushed him forward. She limped after him. The air in the circular chamber smelled of dust and old paper and wood. Museum smells. Soft light illuminated a large stone table, almost a plinth, at the center of the room. Dozens of flags hung in the chamber. The one on Eli's left had the stripes of an American flag, but a squat British flag sat in place of the blue field of stars. The one next to it had a familiar array of 13 stars and stripes, and the one past that had the stars arranged in a circle. Eli followed them around the room, watching the pattern of stars change from grids to circles to uneven arrays and back. His eyes returned to the first one and counted.
47 American flags. Despite the smell in the air, all of them looked new. The last one had a dense grid, 6 rows of 9 stars each. Definitely a plinth, not a table, at the center of the room. A rounded slab of granite? Limestone? It had to be 5 feet across and 2 feet tall. It looked old. Ancient old. It also looked very empty. 41. Harry took a few limping steps forward.
Where is it?
Eli approached the plinth, then gazed around the chamber.
It's not here. Yes, I can see that.
He studied the flags, the vaulted ceiling, the backs of the doors.
We must not be early enough. It must have vanished sooner than everyone thought.
She shook her head.
It vanished in the 60s.
Yeah, but how does anyone know that?
It's what came down the chain.
But how do they know?
I don't know,
she snapped.
It should be here.
Eli heard the rustle of clothes and shoes in the marble room behind them. He shuffled around to face the door. 15 strode into the chamber. He wore his transparent mask, the one Eli had first seen weeks ago and one town over. His suit looked sharp, as if he'd had it cleaned and pressed just for this encounter. Half a dozen immaculate faceless men flanked him on either side.
Being in this room, he said, is an act of treason against the United States punishable by immediate execution.
His pistol came up. The other faceless man mirrored him. Harry reached past Eli, holding something up. For an instant, he thought it was one of her pistols, that he was going to be her human shield in a last stand against the faceless men. But she held a small object between her thumb and finger. A poker chip. She raised it slowly, as unthreateningly as possible, to put it between them and 15. The faceless man's chin went up and his head tilted back, just a little, as if the wooden token had caught his attention. Eli studied the chip himself. Dark red paint, an eerily exact match for blood, ran along the edge and up onto the face at points. Some of it had chipped away or rubbed off over time. Where the bare wood showed, it had the dark, smooth look left by years of handling. The marks on the poker chip's face looked like an elongated loop and skinny triangle, both stretching across the circle. Then, where they intersected, his focus shifted just a little. Just enough. He saw the stylized AP, the sides of the two letters pressed together to form a single line. Harry swiveled her wrist, turning the token back and forth.
You know what this is?
It's a dislocated item, said 15. A poker chip from one of the saloons of Hourglass, California, 1886. You fugitives use them as representative tokens.
It's a favor, said Harry.
She limped up next to Eli, keeping the wooden token in front of them.
Your favor.
15 pulled the slide back on his pistol. It slammed into place with a hard clack that echoed across the second landing, and then the weapon dropped to point at Eli's chest.
Whatever information you may have about the location of the dream can be just as easily cut out of you as long as your head's intact.
Eli swallowed.
Except, Harry said, I'm calling in the favor.
She thrust the poker chip forward like a horror movie nun warding off vampires with her cross. 15 paused. A faceless statue.
You're what?
This is the only favor Abraham Porter ever gave out.
She locked her eyes on the empty sockets of the mask, on the smooth skin beneath the transparent plastic.
That you gave out before you became one of the faceless men. This is your favor. I'm calling it in and asking you to honor it.
15's chin came down, then tilted ever so slightly up again.
I ask for safe passage, she said. Eli and I walk out of here, unharmed, unchanged. No pursuit. We're simply allowed to leave.
She looked at the empty plinth.
To leave all of this.
A moment of silence stretched out in the tabernacle of the dream. 15 took a step forward, then another. He was 12 feet away. 10 feet. 8. The pistol stayed level with Eli's chest. Eli and Harry stood their ground. The faceless man reached out with his free hand and plucked the favor from Harry's grip. The pistol never wavered. His fingers moved up and down, pushing the wooden token onto its edge and over onto the other side. He flipped it again and again. Harry's wounded leg gave out. She fell against Eli with a grunt. Her empty hand still held out in front of them.
Tell me, Mrs. Pritchard, Mr. Teague, why did you, or any of the searchers, think that a faceless man would be bound by some vague contract made by a dead man?
Her hand dropped.
He isn't dead.
Abraham Porter no longer exists.
But he isn't dead, Eli insisted.
You're him.
I had no existence before the faceless men.
Then you're a liar,
said Harry. The poker chip made a crisp, sharp sound as it snapped in half. Eli's stomach dropped. The pistol jabbed into his sternum to catch it.
I, said 15, would mind your tongue. The faceless men are the true heroes of America.
Heroes who don't honor their debts,
said Harry.
Abraham Porter is...
Was a good man, interrupted Eli, trying hard to ignore the pistol.
An honorable man, honorable to a fault, the way Harry tells it. She couldn't imagine a situation where he wouldn't honor a favor when it was called in.
15 closed his fist around the two pieces of the poker chip and squeezed.
It seems I was wrong,
said Harry, pushing her chin up. Eli's gut swirled again and carried up memories of talking over truss, back when the old man was just his boss at a small branch of a bank, of knowing he was either saving his job or ending it, of being almost sick with fear and confident at the same time.
Are the two of you,
asked 15,
familiar with the concept of the filibuster?
Eli glanced at Harry. She met his gaze, then looked at the faceless man.
The what?
The filibuster is a delaying tactic used in the United States Senate to prevent a bill from being brought to the floor for a vote.
Okay, Eli glanced down at the pistol.
The senator must keep talking,
explained 15.
They cannot sit down, they may not take breaks, they cannot eat. They cannot drink anything except water or milk.
Milk?
If any of these rules are violated,
said the faceless man, ignoring him,
or if the Senate invokes cloture, the filibuster is at an end, and the business of government proceeds. Do you understand?
Eli swallowed. No, I'm not sure I do. He glanced at Harry, and she shook her head. 15 opened his fist and let the broken splinters of the favor fall to the stone floor.
I am honoring Abraham Porter's favor in a manner that matches the rules of our government. We are delaying your execution. You may speak for as long as you wish, without moving, without a break, without nourishment. And when you're finished, unless you've somehow convinced me of a reason to let you go, I will shoot each of you in the head.
Harry straightened up.
What?
The faceless man took a step back. The hand holding the pistol settled down to his waist, pointing it between them.
Your time has begun, Mrs. Pritchard. Mr. Teague.
42. Eli stood by the plinth and tried not to focus on the enormous pistol aimed in his general direction. It had to be close to a foot long. The angular barrel had squared off ridges along the top, like the teeth of a gear. Harry leaned against him to keep weight off her leg. 15's trigger finger tensed.
I'll consider 20 seconds of silence the end of your delaying tactic, which is in 6, 5, 4, 3.
Wait, said Eli. So we're just supposed to talk and make a case for you not to shoot us?
Yes, said the faceless man.
That wasn't what I asked for, said Harry. I requested safe passage.
Which you will have, 15 said, if certain conditions are met.
She glared at him.
This is not how favors work.
Mrs. Pritchard, I am only even considering this to honor the memory of Abraham Porter, a fine American and a veteran. If you prefer, we can skip directly to the execution.
Okay, Eli blurted out. You've got us. We came here to steal the dream.
As one, the faceless men tensed. Harry shot him a look. Eli took a breath and tried to organize his thoughts.
We used Zeke's badge.
Zero,
said 15.
We used Zero's badge to gain access to your secure headquarters. We thought if we could get the dream, if we turned out to be the ones who stole it, then we could also return it. We could end all of this. We had good intentions, but the dream was already gone, he continued, waving his hand at the empty plinth. So we couldn't steal it. We didn't do anything wrong.
Regardless of the dream's location, said 15, your intent was theft. You have entered the rotunda. The punishment is execution.
Yeah, but why isn't... Eli counted off a few seconds. Are we allowed to ask questions during this thing?
You are, 15 said. I'm under no obligation to answer them.
Okay then, Eli sighed. If the dream isn't here, why do you have to kill us?
Because only the faceless men are allowed in the rotunda,
said the fox-masked faceless man.
In order to keep the dream secure.
But it isn't here.
Irrelevant, said 15.
More to the point, said Harry. Why isn't it here? It's the early 20th century. The dream didn't vanish until the 60s.
In fact, Mrs. Pritchard, it was 1898 when you and Mr. Teague entered the Founder's House.
Then where's the dream? It should be.
The main office exists outside the normal flow of time. It is always now here.
Which now? Eli asked.
All of them.
Harry glanced at Eli.
Is that why Sanders is different?
Because of its proximity to the dream,
said 15 with a nod.
The town of Sanders exists outside the normal flow of history. As such, the town and its citizens are anomalies for us. They represent uncertainty.
Citizens, said Eli. You mean me?
That's correct. Like all citizens of Sanders, you are an anomaly.
It isn't that there's something weird about me, it's the whole town?
Sanders is, from a temporal point of view, the most important town in the country, possibly in the entire world, if you consider the role of the United States on a global scale.
Eli's shoulder twinged where he'd been shot. Memories of the Boston bus station and fleeing the fork in the road swirled behind his eyes. Harry commenting how lucky. 15 made a tiny gesture with his pistol.
5 seconds. 4. 3.
That's how I got away at the bus station, Eli said. That's how Harry and I kept getting away.
He looked down at himself, over at her.
That's why Zeke Zero didn't kill me. That's why you're all right up close to us now. You're uncertain. You can miss me.
The empty sockets of 15's mask stared at him.
If Zero was also an anomaly, said Harry. Why did you take him?
Our recruitment criteria are not for public knowledge.
It was because of me, said Eli. He looked at Harry. I was traveling with you, so you were uncertain too. They were trying to even the odds, cancel out our advantage. But it didn't work, did it? Eli spat out the ideas as fast as they formed. Zeke just became an uncertain, faceless man. He was just as unpredictable to you as I was.
Very perceptive, Mr. Teague.
He's hurt, Eli said. Back in, what did you say, 1898? He was in a crash.
We are aware. The faceless men take care of our own.
Eli nodded and ran the paradox through his head again. Harry's gaze drifted to the empty plinth.
Is it possible that someone from Sanders took the dream?
No. We have searched the town extensively.
When?
15 said nothing. Oh, Christ, said Eli. Harry glanced at him.
What?
He looked at her, at the plinth, at 15.
I think I know where the dream is. Right where it is.
The faceless men tensed. The empty sockets of 15's mask bored into him. The huge pistol rose up and settled a few inches from Eli's chest.
Where is it?
Eli closed his eyes for a moment, studying the thin line of thoughts that had fallen together in his mind. He worked through the line, through the chain of events, to make sure he hadn't doomed Harry and himself.
It's complicated.
Mr. Teague, if this is an attempt to delay your filibuster...
No, no, he waved his hands. John Henry mentioned an idea to me that he thought we were running out of history because the dream was gone, that things were unraveling, getting eaten up. It's what first got me thinking. In programming, sometimes you have something called a recursive function. It's a function that calls itself, and it'll keep doing it again and again until it gets the answer it wants. But if the function isn't written right, it'll just keep calling itself forever. And it eventually eats up all the system memory and causes a stack overflow. The computer crashes.
15's head shifted to the left.
You believe the dream has created some kind of loop?
I think it's made a lot of them.
He looked at Harry.
Like how we stopped Zero. I knew the trees would stop his car because I'd already seen the car stopped when I was a kid, but it was only there to see because I'd already done it. The predestination paradox, said Harry.
Right. He looked at the faceless men again. As I understand it, the Founding Fathers created the dream, or had it created, in the 1770s, and it existed for the next 200 years or so as America grew and expanded.
Until it was stolen in 1963.
15 said.
We'll get to that,
Eli said, waving away the interruption. The real point is, something else was going on in the United States for those 200 years, too.
Beneath the clear mask, 15's flesh rippled.
We were.
Eli looked at her.
Me and Harry. Harry and Christopher. John Henry. Alice Ramsey and Abraham Porter and Phoebe Fitzgerald. James and Monica and Theo. Everyone at Hourglass. All of the searchers. And all the faceless men. We were there, traveling back and forth looking for the dream.
Because it had vanished,
said 15. He nodded.
Right. But from a chronological point of view, we were there first. That's the nature of traveling in history,
said Harry.
Effect sometimes comes before cause, like hearing the train whistle in Independence.
Right, said Eli.
Exactly. So for 200 plus years, hundreds of searchers were looking for the dream.
He turned his attention back to 15. Plus all of your people looking to get it back too.
Maybe thousands of us, from a certain point of view, when you consider people overlapping as they travel to different periods. And based off what Harry's told me, what happens when a community of thousands of people want the same thing, when they all believe the same thing? What's the dream do?
The faceless man didn't move. Eli counted off 14 seconds before the masked head moved side to side.
No,
Harry said.
No,
echoed 15.
That's wrong.
I don't think so, said Eli. It all makes sense. No, it doesn't,
Harry said.
It does, said Eli. Thousands of searchers looking for it. Hundreds of faceless men trying to get it back for hundreds of years, overlapping again and again and again. So finally, the dream makes what they want possible.
His gaze fell on the empty slab of stone.
It vanishes. It has to.
so we can all search for it.
15 shook his head again.
Our sworn duty is to find it. It's the searcher's goal as well. If this was a mechanism of the dream, as you suggest, then it would have been found by now.
I don't think so, said Eli. Because the searchers all individually want to find it themselves. Each of them has their own ideas on how the search should end and which of them should find it.
The faceless men don't. Our one goal,
according to Harry, since you became one of the faceless men, your goal has been to wipe out the searchers.
15 said nothing. Eli took a breath and organized his remaining thoughts.
Nobody knows how the dream was stolen, right? How somebody found your base, made it past all of you, and then back out with the dream.
We are investigating several possibilities.
I'm an anomaly, said Eli, and we had one of your badges. We didn't even get to the stairs before you spotted us.
He gestured past 15 at the line of faceless men. We never would have made it back out.
Agreed.
So how did someone else do it? If we couldn't do it with those advantages, how did someone get all the way in here and back out without any of you seeing them?
Harry looked at the plinth, at the doors, at the faceless men.
It would be impossible.
It would be, Eli agreed. Nobody could have made it past all of the faceless men. It couldn't happen. Unless the dream stole itself.
No,
said 15. Eli shook his head.
If someone else had it, shouldn't we all see their influence somewhere else in the country? Shouldn't there be another slow town out there? One that's lagging behind history?
15 didn't respond.
If the dream vanished 30 years before I was born, why are we still seeing all of its effects here in Sanders?
Eli's gut churned. A bead of sweat ran down his back. The awful sense of a moment of truth loomed over him again.
There's only one place the dream can be, he told 15. It hid itself in the last place anyone would look.
He reached his hand out over the empty plinth. He couldn't quite reach the center without leaning, but he got pretty close. 2 feet of empty space stretched between his palm and the limestone plinth. Harry shuffled her feet to stay leaning against him.
You said it's always now here, right?
15 didn't move. The blank skin behind his mask didn't flinch.
So that either means the dream was never here, or...
Eli lowered his hand and set it on top of the dream. 43. Harry gasped. Eli turned his head and, as it had for him a few times in the past, time slowed to a halt. Growing up in Sanders had been boring most of the time, and he and his friends had all declared various plans to escape their town. Eli would be an archaeologist and dig up old battlefields around the world. Robin wanted to draw comic books. Josh had plotted out a path to the Supreme Court. For almost 3 years, Corey had been obsessed with movie special effects. He'd rent sci-fi movies from the Emporium and watch them again and again, studying how things had been done. None of them could go a week without at least one intense lecture about Ray Harryhausen or Stan Winston or Phil Tippett. The idea of forced perspective had come up a lot. Tricks to make small things look big or big things look small. According to Corey, it usually involved models, special sets, and camera lenses that worked like bifocal glasses. Done right, the effects looked amazing. Done wrong, they looked like models and sets. All the objects Eli could see around the dream. The plinth, the flags, the lid of the wooden case, even his own outstretched hand, gave off the subtle, unconscious cues that told him he was seeing the thing inside the case in forced perspective. That he wasn't seeing its true size. That he couldn't see its full size. It looked like a model of an atom, its swirling rings etched with symbols. Then it turned and looked like a mechanical snake twisting around to swallow its own tail. Another twist, and it looked like an old-fashioned astronomical model with planets and moons whirling on concentric rings. The surfaces of the dream gleamed with gold and brass, dark wood and ivory, glass and iron. Dense,
intricate detail covered some parts. Were those hieroglyphs around the image of the eagle? While others had been polished smooth. He looked at himself in its mirrored surfaces and couldn't shake the feeling it looked back at him. Then the moment ended. The gentle pressure of his hand landing on the lid pushed it shut. The box closed with a low thump, hiding the dream from his view just seconds after he'd found it. His palm rested on the wooden case. The thump echoed back to him, and he looked up. The faceless men had all dropped to one knee, even 15 right in front of them. Their heads were bowed, their hats in their hands. It struck Eli that their pose made them look like a group of knights waiting for a blessing, or for orders. What's going on?
Mr. Teague,
said 15, not raising his head.
You have custody of the American Dream.
Harry shuffled closer.
It's yours,
she whispered.
You did it. You found the dream.
I did?
You have custody of the dream,
15 repeated.
The country is now yours to shape and guide.
Eli looked down at the faceless man. Could you stand up, please? It's kind of weird talking to you like this. 15 rose to his full height. His pistol vanished into his coat, but his hat stayed in his hands, and his chin stayed down.
Is this better, Mr. Teague?
I guess. Why are you all... He looked at the other faceless men. Why are you doing this?
The faceless men serve the dream, said 15. And the dream now serves you.
Consarn it,
murmured Harry. Eli looked at her, at the wooden case. How does this work?
No one knows,
she said.
Until now, this had just been part of the story.
How do the other parts of the story go? What do I do? Do I have to phrase my wish in the form of a question or something? 15 raised his chin a half inch.
If I may.
Yeah, sure.
The dream affects beliefs. It strengthens them, but it can also shape them. As the custodian of the dream, you may decide which direction the country will take.
You mean I can control what people think?
More how they think, their leanings and preferences.
As of when?
Whenever you want. We are outside of history here. You may begin where and when you like.
The faceless man's muffled words carried a terrible weight. The weight of failure. How long do I have to decide what I want to do?
Consider it, said the faceless man. Like chess. Your move isn't complete until you remove your hand.
Harry took his other hand, squeezed it once. Let go. Eli looked down at the case. It was almost 2 foot square. He was no expert, but he thought the wood was oak. Plain, but well made. He'd probably never give it a second look at a yard sale or antique store. He could feel the warmth of it, the power seeping up into his fingertips. He imagined it making him strong and powerful, like the comic book superheroes he'd read about as a kid. This could be his origin story, the point when his life finally started to mean something, the moment that he... This shouldn't be about me, he said. 15's chin went up another half inch. I mean it. Eli shook his head. Even if the dream was supposed to belong to one person, I shouldn't be the guy shaping the country, no matter how much it might need it. Before these past few weeks, I'd barely met anyone who didn't live within 30 miles of me. I hadn't seen any of the country. Hell, I barely ever left Sanders. The whole idea was that everyone would have a chance to live the life they wanted, right? It was never intended to let somebody force their dream on everyone else. He patted the wooden case with his fingertips. The Founding Fathers were right to keep this locked away. To leave it with you. 15 bowed his head.
Thank you, Mr. Teague. So, what will you do with it?
He looked at the box. At Harry. I thought I wanted to go home, but really I was just scared. Truth is, all I ever wanted was to get out, to see everything else. And I can do that now.
Then you release the dream back into our custody.
The muscles shifted in Eli's arm, his palm lifted off the wooden case, dragging his fingers behind it. He opened his mouth to speak, and Harry pushed his hand back down onto the box.
Wait, will we be safe?
15 turned the blank gaze of his mask on her.
Safe?
Eli took in a breath and pressed his hand against the case.
Yeah, safe, he echoed. I'm not going to move my hand and then you kill both of us?
The faceless man said nothing.
Being in here is punishable by execution, right?
So here's my one wish, or order, or whatever. Harry and I leave here without being killed. He looked at her and thought of Christopher Pritchard, of Phoebe Fitzgerald, of Theo Knickerbocker.
Nobody else gets killed.
15 bowed his head.
It will be as you say, Mr. Teague.
Eli looked at Harry. Her chin dipped once. Her eyes stayed on his.
Okay, then, he said. I'm releasing it.
Back into our custody?
Yes.
He cleared his throat and raised his voice. I release the American dream back into the custody of the faceless men. He raised his hand. Static electricity crackled under his fingertips like the screen of an old television set. He stretched his fingers wide and lifted them away from the lid. The wood box sat on the stone plinth, unmoving, unconcerned. The faceless men rose to their feet as one. Hats slid back above masks. Pistols vanished into coats. 15 reached up and set his fedora on his blank skull.
Thank you again, Mr. Teague.
You're welcome. 15 extended one finger to point at Eli's chest.
Remove them, now.
The faceless men leaped forward. 44. The faceless men slammed into Eli. The clown and the gaunt one grabbed his arms and yanked him away from the sandstone plinth. Eli struggled, but it was like fighting statues. The chamber spun, a whirlwind of marble and flags. He caught a glimpse of two other faceless men lifting Harry as she kicked and fought. His feet stumbled as they dragged him away. The brightness of the marble antechamber made him squint. The doors of the rotunda swung shut and closed. A click echoed from the restored keyhole. They hauled him back, and Eli's stomach lurched as he began to drop. They'd thrown him out onto the staircase, he realized, to break countless bones as he tumbled and crashed down 40 feet worth of marble steps. He wondered if the fall would kill him. But they held on, dragging him backward as they charged down the stairs with an eerie metronomic speed and precision. The marble room rushed away, and the heavy curtains closed across the staircase. They held him facing the archway, but the sounds of motion and typing and muffled conversations reached his ears. The two faceless men released Eli's arms and stepped away. After the whirlwind trip away from the dream and down the stairs, the lack of support left him swaying. He shuffled his feet into better positions and looked around. Harry stood a few yards away, favoring her bad leg, flanked by her own pair of faceless men. She brushed her hair out of her face and shook her coat back into position. Her eyes met Eli's and mirrored his own confusion. The clown dipped his head and held out Eli's derby. A faceless man with an expressionless mask presented Harry's tricorn. 15 stood before the curtain. He strode forward between Eli and Harry. The sounds of business and work faded to silence.
The dream has been restored, he boomed to the chamber.
His voice echoed across the massive room. Applause broke out. Some of the faceless men cheered, the sounds muffled by flesh and distance. It reminded Eli of old newsreels, of polite, contained expressions of joy. The noise level settled back to normal, although the chamber seemed brighter, more energetic, unburdened.
All remaining agents in the field should be recalled, said the gaunt, faceless man with the fox mask.
Agreed, said 15. At this point, all efforts should be put toward relocation.
Eli glanced at Harry. Relocation? 15's blank face turned to aim at Eli.
The security of the dream has been compromised.
Harry shook her head.
No, she said. It hasn't.
Eli's correct. It's never left your care.
Security has been compromised, said 15, extending a finger. By the two of you.
Something rolled over in Eli's gut. Harry's hands settled low at her sides, right by the holsters holding her empty pistols. Her eyes flicked from side to side, watching the faceless men around them.
The dream will be moved, the faceless man continued, because its location and the location of the office have been confirmed by outside parties. This action follows all existing protocols.
Eli blinked.
What's that mean?
The Founding Fathers were very thorough, said 15. Contingencies exist for almost every situation, including a compromised location.
His blank face swung back and forth, pointing at each of them.
The dream will be moved, and the office of the Faceless Men with it. This time tomorrow, the Founder's house will just be an abandoned hotel near the center of Sanders. This will have some effects on your hometown, Mr. Teague. Most noticeably...
What happens to us?
Said Harry, her fingers flexed reflexively by the holsters. For a man with no face, Eli thought 15 did an amazing job of looking confused.
What do you mean?
You said we've compromised the security of the dream.
You did,
agreed 15. The empty sockets of his mask turned to Eli.
You've seen the dream. Touched it, even. You both now know where it's located within our base of operations, and where our base is. This is why we need to relocate.
Eli and Harry waited.
And?
She asked.
And nothing, said 15. Per Mr. Teague's request, there will be no punishment.
Eli counted three heartbeats.
So, you're just letting us go?
Correct,
said 15. He gestured down an aisle of desks and file cabinets.
This way, please.
15 marched forward. Eli and Harry followed, her arm draped across his shoulders. Two faceless men fell into step on either side of them, with two more shoulder to shoulder behind them. It felt like a Secret Service kind of formation, the way a president would be guided through a crowd. Harry cleared her throat.
What about Eleanor?
15 turned his head to her without slowing.
Who?
The car, Eli said. Our car.
The 1929 Model A business coupe,
said 15 with a nod.
It's currently a dislocated object in 1898. It will be retrieved and restored to any appropriate era you wish.
Thank you,
said Harry. Their group moved smoothly through the swarm of faceless men, passing maps and desks and card catalogs. They turned once beneath one of the massive chandeliers, marched down a second aisle, and came to a wide set of double doors. The formation shifted around Eli and Harry as a faceless man on either side stepped forward to hold them open so 15 never broke pace. The hallway beyond looked like a hospital basement with pale green floors and stripes on the walls. Their footsteps echoed against the concrete. It reminded Eli of his recent injuries.
What about Zeke and his hornet?
He asked. What'll happen to them?
As you've no doubt realized, Mr. Teague, said 15, half turning his head to his shoulder, the Hudson Hornet will remain where it crashed. It is dislocated, but the nature of Sanders should prevent it from causing any damage to the timeline.
And Zeke?
Zero will be repaired and go through rehabilitation. It's my own fault for rushing him into the field. Adjusting to the nature of being a faceless man is overwhelming for some people. More so if they are an anomaly. We'll repair his wounds and his mind. The faceless men have always taken care of our own.
Will it work?
Eli asked. Will you really be able to help him?
It took several years, said the clown, walking at Eli's shoulder. But eventually I was able to resume my duties and responsibilities. Thank you for your concern.
Eli stared at the sockets above the plastic smile, at the shape of the skull behind the mask.
Zeke?
I am currently known as 33,
Mr. Teague.
Are you okay?
I have health, certainty, and purpose. I am one of the faceless men, and always have been.
That's good.
33 gave a polite nod. They came to a single door with a large glass window. Sunlight fell through it to make a bright square on the concrete floor. 15 stopped with his toes just on the edge of the light. In the distance, Eli could see buildings, an open space, and what looked like some kind of snow-covered scaffolding. Then the images lined up in his mind, and he realized he was seeing the baseball field bleachers from behind. They were looking out one of the back doors of the founder's house.
You're free to go, said 15. You may also continue using the dream's effects to travel through our country's history.
Harry's brows went up.
Really?
It's a natural consequence of the dream's existence. It isn't our place to restrict it. We will, however, continue to monitor for disruptions to the timeline of the United States. Any serious incidents will be dealt with. Harshly.
I understand, she said.
Excellent, said the faceless man. Please pass word of this along to your fellow searchers.
33 stepped around his superior and opened the door. The sunlight shifted angles. Cold air rolled into the hall. Off in the distance, a car engine chugged away, a very modern engine to Eli's ear. Eli turned to Harry. A few loose strands of blonde hair swung free from her tricorn and caught the sun. Shall we? He said.
Yes,
she said.
Yes, I think we shall.
15 reached out and set a hand on Harry's shoulder.
Not you, Mrs. Pritchard.
Her arm stiffened across Eli's shoulders. His tightened on her waist.
Why not? You told us we were free to leave,
she said.
And you are, said 15. You were promised freedom, but not freedom together. Mr. Teague must be returned. He'll be the only one leaving this way.
Eli and Harry looked at each other.
Returned? Where?
To Sanders, the faceless man said, gesturing at the door. Your town is an anomaly. You are part of the town. It needs to be as complete as possible when it catches up with the rest of the country.
What?
Your town will be freed of the dream's influence. Its progress will no longer be slowed. I'd expect the first few weeks to be startling. You can also be an active agent there, helping to smooth over any confusion or suspicion that may arise.
He's my partner,
said Harry. 15 nodded.
And most likely will be again, eventually.
Eli frowned. How long is that?
As long as it takes for new connections to establish between Sanders and history. Weeks, months perhaps, no more than a few years.
A few years? They both said at once.
I wish I could be more exact. Nothing like this has ever happened before, or will ever happen again. It's a unique moment in American history. As I said before, Sanders is one of the most important places in the country.
Eli and Harry looked at each other. Her grip on his shoulders loosened.
What if,
Eli began.
There's no way around it,
15 told them.
Once you leave, Mr. Teague, relocation will cut off the town. There will be no more of the slick spots, as you like to call them. Not here, at least. The only way to travel in and out of Sanders will be the same way everyone else does.
He gestured at the door.
I...
Eli looked at Harry, the door, back to Harry.
Thanks, I guess.
Thanks?
For saving my life half a dozen times? And not dumping me on the side of the road somewhere? Thanks for convincing me to finally get out of my town.
You did that on your own,
she said.
Even if it was for very stupid reasons.
He chuckled.
Yeah, I guess they were.
She wrapped her arms around him and squeezed. She was a good height to hug. They fit well in each other's arms.
Thank you for Everything.
I guess I'll see you sometime, maybe.
She glanced at 15.
Eventually,
she said. She took a few limping steps back.
I'll find you again. I promise.
I'll be waiting.
45. He stepped out of the founder's house into a patch of snow and heard the door shut behind him. He looked over his shoulder and saw an empty hallway through smudged glass. He wondered if Harry and 15 and 33 stood there watching him, hidden from sight, or if the dream had already moved them along to somewhere else. He looked up at the sprawling structure, hoping to see any sign of life, and saw none. He shuffled through the ankle-deep snow, across the back lot, down the gravel side road, and out onto the slush-covered street. No Hudson Hornets, no Model A, nothing. He walked through the slush toward the Silver Arrow. Within half an hour, he learned he'd been gone for over 3 months. He'd missed Christmas and New Year's. People had given up hope. His mother had gone past hysterics to mourning. The fact that Eli's apartment had been found vandalized with the door kicked in and that Zeke Miller vanished a few days later had led to numerous whispered theories. Small towns might not run on gossip, but it tended to be a standard alternative fuel source. People talked a bit louder about Zeke's temper, his stalkerish behavior towards some women, his long history with Eli. Sealed school records became points of coffee shop discussion. Depending on who was asked, Eli had been run out of town, kidnapped, or possibly even murdered. Eli shook his head at all of it. As he explained to many people with complete honesty, he hadn't seen Zeke's face in months. When asked where he'd been, he shrugged and managed to look embarrassed. He'd been struck with wanderlust, taken a few days off, and just kept going. The impulsive after-college road trip, many years late. There may have been a woman involved. People sighed and smiled. Dependable Eli Teague could be just as irresponsible as the rest of them sometimes. It fit well into the history they all liked to believe. Over the next few days, he went back to the station to give statements about his absence to Captain Deacon, to the state police out of Alfred, and to a bored-looking FBI agent out of Portland who'd been called in when Eli's car was found in Boston. A missing persons case had been opened, and procedures had to be followed before it could be closed. No, he hadn't been kidnapped. No, he hadn't been threatened. No, he hadn't seen Officer Miller during that time. Eli sat in the chair and answered all their questions with a straight face.
"Are you a steampunk fan?"
Eli blinked.
"What?"
"Steampunk." The FBI agent pointed his pen at the hat sitting on Deacon's desk.
"I've got a friend who is. She has a bowler, too."
"It's a derby," corrected Eli.
"What's the difference?"
"I'm not really sure," he said, "but I'm pretty sure there is one."
"Not into steampunk, though."
Eli shook his head.
"Strange choice for a hat, then."
Eli shrugged. "Used to be the most popular hat in the country." The FBI agent smirked as he packed up his paperwork, his first real expression in their five-minute discussion.
"Yeah, well, what was it Obama said about horses and bayonets?"
Eli's car had been towed from the Boston parking structure and impounded. He owed 13 weeks of storage fees, a frightening sum, if he wanted it back. Much to his surprise, his apartment was still his. Captain Deacon had labeled it a crime scene after Zeke's disappearance. The lock on the door had been fixed, but the rest of the small space had been left as they'd found it. Eli cleaned up a few things and threw away many more. His bed felt too soft. So he dragged the blankets onto the floor, cracked the windows open, and slept soundly in the cold, fresh air. He'd been equally surprised to find out he still had a job. Bill had hired a new systems person, a woman with spiky hair, dark eyes, and a much more impressive resume than Eli, but after his absence and reported disappearance, no one had gone through the actual motions of firing him. Bill told him they'd sort things out, either getting him a position at another branch or at least some back pay so he'd have a cushion while he looked for something new. Eli spent his free time checking in with his friends. Jack in the Box, the fast food franchise, had slipped into Sanders and made a quiet offer for the Emporium building. Corey and Robin had considered it for all of 2 days and accepted it with a little encouraging nudge from Eli. The tidy sum, more than they'd make in a decade of video rentals, would let Robin go back to art school and Corey launch a Twitch show with a sizable budget. When the gossip mill became too much, Nicole had packed up and moved a few towns over into New Hampshire. A manager position had opened up at one of the big multiplex cinemas in Newington. Eli stopped by to visit and found her planning her film festival. They both smiled and spoke warmly, but the recent events had stomped out whatever spark the two of them might have once had. Nicole kissed him on the cheek as they hugged goodbye, and Eli felt sure he'd never see her again. Even his mom had good news, despite all of her worry about her son. It turned out the family home sat in a geographically perfect spot for a cell phone tower. The day after he talked with the FBI agent, a company approached her about building on her small patch of land, deep on the back of the property line. The lease was double what she made as a librarian. It seemed as if the American dream had finally caught up with Sanders. And then, right on cue, Eli got fired. Bill asked him if he could swing by the bank. When Eli arrived, his boss, his ex-boss he already suspected, looked close to a panic attack. "She's been waiting to talk to you," said Bill. "She wouldn't leave. Said she wanted to explain things to you personally." Helena stood at the back of the bank, next to one of the spare desks. Eli glanced out through the blinds. He didn't see the Cadillac 60 special anywhere in the parking lot, but he couldn't see the whole lot from where he was. Was this another case of timelines not lining up? Could this be an earlier visit from her point of view? He walked closer, away from Bill and the others. Helena stared at him like a bug. A thin scar, at least a year old, ran along the side of her forehead. The kind of thing you'd end up with, he guessed, if someone pistol-whipped you. Truss was still dead. Or dead already. Dead to both of them? Which meant what to Helena? The woman reached into her jacket. Eli tensed, prepared to leap behind the flimsy barrier of the cubicle partition. It wouldn't offer much in the way of protection, but it would keep him out of line of sight, for Helena pulled out an envelope.
"Mr. Elias Teague," she said.
Her voice had a soft edge, almost a lisp. She had impressive projection, but the air itself blunted her words.
"The situation with your employment has come to the attention of Mr. Truss. I am sure it comes as no surprise that under the terms outlined in your contract, you've been terminated, effective immediately."
Eli said nothing. He'd expected as much.
"However,"
she continued in the same lisping tenor,
"Mr. Truss has offered you a token severance payment in recognition of your years of service."
She held out the envelope. Eli stared at the woman, leaned in a little closer.
"Mr. Truss," he murmured, "is dead. Arguably, he's been dead for 130 years.
Helena said nothing.
"What is this, some kind of final revenge? Hate mail from beyond the grave? Did he buy out my mom's mortgage or get my citizenship revoked or something?"
The woman held the envelope out like a blade raised to slash down. Everyone in the bank had their eyes on the exchange, even if they couldn't hear the quieter parts of it. Eli took the envelope, tore it open. When a cloud of poison dust didn't poof out, he opened it all the way. Inside sat a check. A large one. Eli counted 9 digits before the decimal point, then counted again to make sure. "What's this supposed to be?"
"Mr. Truss may have passed on," said Helena, now in a much lower tone, "but he's left an impressive corporate structure behind. One which won't notice his absence for months, maybe even years."
"So you're in charge now?"
"Mr. Truss is in charge,"
she said, blinking too innocently.
"Just as he's always been. And I'll deliver his messages to all the various executives and district managers, just as I always have."
Eli held up the envelope. "So this is A bribe?
An incentive,
lisped Helena.
I don't want any hard feelings between us. Go out, live the life you always wanted. There are people keeping tabs on you these days. People who would listen to you. As I see it, if you're busy and happy, you won't feel inclined to talk to any of them about me. Which means things here can continue as they are.
So, it's a bribe. Helena smirked.
If it makes you happy to call it that. Either way, you're fired. What happens next is up to you.
Eli folded the envelope and the check and stuffed them in his back pocket. And what if I decide it's not enough? She shrugged and reached into her jacket. She pulled something out and pressed it into Eli's palm. She had very warm fingers. A wooden poker chip with golden yellow edges and a pair of marked signs, cents and dollars, each one with two vertical lines running through it.
I owe you one,
Helena said.
Good enough?
Eli flipped the favor back and forth between his fingers. Yeah, he said. Yeah, it is.
Then our business is concluded, Mr. Teague,
she said at a regular volume. She gave a short bow, walked past Eli, and gestured for Bill to join her at another desk. Eli walked over to the other spare cubicle. His belongings waited in a box there. He tried to think of anything in the box worth taking home, but decided it would be rude to just leave it behind for Bill or someone else to deal with. The new systems tech, he realized he'd never learned her name, stood up inside her cubicle.
Axed you?
Yeah.
Sucks. It's okay. Better than a couple of years ago,
she agreed. Yeah.
Any tips on keeping everything up and running?
She asked. It had the distinct air of a polite rhetorical question. Nope. Actually, yes. There's a buggy line in the transfer code. I think I flagged it just before I left, but it never got fixed. She glanced down at her computer.
Seriously?
Yeah. Sorry.
You think you flagged it?
He tried to shrug, but the box interfered. Instead, he gestured back at Helena. Mr. Truss showed up in person, messed up the whole day. She said, this time in a tone that implied she'd already heard stories about Archibald Truss. Eli nodded. Good luck.
See you around.
Another week passed. He checked in with his mom every day. He went out with his friends on Tuesday night. They smiled at his derby. Robin still wanted to know about the woman who'd given it to him, refusing to believe there wasn't a story with a woman behind the small-brimmed hat. He used his banking skills to set up a few different accounts. His big check went into one, then spread out into the others. He could be rich now or comfortable for the rest of his life. He went with comfortable. More weeks passed by. Eli spent his days walking around town. He visited Jackson's and looked through the last wire comic rack. He stopped by the Emporium during its big closeout sale. He stood outside the theater, which still had last month's playbill taped in the box office window. He bought a nice lunch at the Silver Arrow one day and two oily slices at Pizza Pub on another. Had the buildings in Sanders always been so close together? He tried three different stores in the area, searching for a new coat. He found a thigh-length overcoat he liked in the York thrift store. Simple lines, strong stitches, wooden buttons. One day in early March, he circled the founder's house a dozen times. Nothing moved in the windows or curled from the chimneys. On his 13th circuit, Corey appeared. Hey, he called out. Hey, Eli replied. I thought you guys were still packing. Corey nodded his head back toward the Emporium, its top floor just peeking out between two other buildings. We are. Robin saw you walking around over here, recognized the hat. Eli touched the brim and smiled. Guess it does make me stand out a bit. Pretty sure it's the only one in town. Corey lifted his chin and studied the old building. Remember when we were kids and we'd run up the front steps here? Yeah. I gotta be honest, Corey said. Place used to scare the shit out of me when we were little. Even just now, when Robin asked me to come see what you were up to, I got a little case of the heebies. It's just an old building, said Eli. Oh, yeah, I know that. Now. But back when we were little, I'm pretty sure monsters lived in it then. Eli smiled again. Truer words.
They started walking again, heading toward the front steps.
So,
Corey said, shoving his hands in his pockets.
What are you doing?
He waved a hand up at the founder's house.
Just looking.
Okay. Eli took off his hat and rubbed the back of his head.
Sorry. Had a lot on my mind. Figured.
Corey glanced up at the building again.
I've got to be honest. I'm kind of half tempted to chuck a rock in a window. I won't tell anybody. Nah, just my luck. Barney'd see me do it too. Goddamn perfect Barney, said Eli.
Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, he's making every other guy in town look bad. Can he just gain a couple pounds or get a zit or something?
They both chuckled, then walked the rest of the way to the big staircase in silence.
So, what are you doing, Eli?
Nothing. Like I said, just looking.
No, I mean...
Corey paused, arranged his thoughts.
You know, when you first vanished before all the Zeke stuff started, you know what we all thought?
What?
Finally. Me and Robin and Josh, even Nicole, we all figured you just finally decided it was time to leave, to go do something with your life.
Eli raised an eyebrow at him.
Look, you know I love you, me and Robin both, but the bank fired you last week, right?
Yeah, almost 10 days ago now.
And you've picked up the check the last 3 times we've gone out, so I know you got a ton of back pay or severance or something.
Severance, said Eli. They were generous.
Corey shrugged.
So what are you waiting for? You're a smart guy. You could do anything, anywhere.
He turned away from the founder's house and looked out across the town.
It's time to move on, buddy.
46. The classified ad caught his eye. A mint green 1967 Chevy Impala. As is, some work needed. He called the owner and they talked for a few minutes. The man gave Eli an address in Kittery and said he could stop by that evening. Eli borrowed his mother's car and went to check it out.
Had a couple calls about it,
said the owner, who introduced himself as Bear. His heavy frame spoke of youthful muscles gone soft after years of being bathed in beer.
Mostly college kids. They want to know if they can get it painted black like that Supernatural car.
Eli didn't understand the reference. The only two Supernatural cars he could think of were a red 58 Plymouth Fury and a customized 71 Lincoln Continental Mark III. Nobody would ever mistake a 67 Impala for either of them. Bear took him over to the garage, walked past it, and pulled a tarp off the vehicle there. As Eli had suspected, the Impala was mountain green, not mint. The paint was faded in places, worn away down to metal in others. Rust coated the undercarriage. Salt corrosion had eaten a few tiny holes in the floorboards, and one the size of a half dollar behind the driver's seat. All four tires were smoother than an old pair of sneakers. It had been a long time since the car had a roof over its head. Not the best thing in New England. The engine looked good, though, and the battery was new. Bear repeated the Impala's need for some work, then asked for a large sum.
It being a classic and all.
Eli countered with 2/3 as much, pointing out how much repairs would cost. They batted prices back and forth for a few minutes before settling on an amount Eli said he could pay in cash. He caught a ride from Corey the next day and drove home with his new car. He stopped for new tires first. Second, a general tune-up of the engine, transmission, brakes, and alignment. New headlights as well. Saturday, when he had the car inspected, he slipped the mechanic an extra 50. The woman set a few metal plates along the Impala's floor to cover the holes and deemed the car roadworthy. He didn't bother to touch up the weather-beaten green paint, automotive camouflage. People rarely broke into a car that looked like crap. The night after he screwed his own license plates on the Impala, he took his mother out to dinner and told her his plans. More or less. The following night, he met up with his friends at the bar in Dover, bought them a few rounds of drinks and nachos, and explained what he was doing. Josh shook his head and laughed. Robin smiled and looked at the Derby. Corey nodded approvingly. The following morning, 2 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days after his return, Eli Teague kissed his mother goodbye, climbed into his beat-up Impala, and left Sanders. He took the southern route, driving down Interstate 95 and eventually cutting across 85 to 40 West. The Impala's radio didn't work, and while that would have driven him nuts at one point in his life, he found the sounds of the road soothing enough. When he got tired, he pulled into rest stop parking lots and slept in his car, with his derby tipped down over his eyes. He changed clothes twice in the passenger seat, ate most of his meals behind the wheel. As he passed through Memphis, he considered diverting south to New Orleans. He wondered how it had changed in the 160 years since he'd last been there. The exit for southbound 55 came and went. He didn't look back. Eli drove through Amarillo, Albuquerque, and Flagstaff before entering California. He allowed himself one detour and took the Impala down through Los Angeles to cut back and drive up the coast. The Pacific Ocean was beautiful, but as a lifelong New Englander, he couldn't shake the surreal feeling that the water stretched out the wrong way, especially when the sun went down. He spent a night in a San Luis Obispo hotel, where he took a long shower and slept until the maid woke him up the next morning. He ate a late breakfast at a diner near the beach, filled up the Impala's gas tank, and got back on the road. Noon passed before he reached Sacramento. He drove through and continued northeast, into the mountains. He reached over and dragged the legal pad off the passenger seat. A few glances confirmed the directions he'd spent hours searching for online and in library books. He reached the small ranger's station a little after 4 o'clock, but the park ranger had already left. Eli glanced through the window at the one-room office and wondered how often he or she came by to check on things. A gate stretched across the dirt road, chained at the middle, so Eli drove the Impala around the building and back onto the southbound road. He passed a few weathered, charred beams reaching up from the ground. A wooden sign stood near them. He guessed it described the site as the remains of a barn. Another 3 minutes of driving brought him to Hourglass. Half the buildings had vanished altogether. Half of what remained had become wooden skeletons. According to the few snippets of history he'd been able to find, the first time around had caught fire on May 31st, 1886, killing 9 people as it burned to the ground. The chandeliers had been a huge fire hazard after all. The bank had closed in July, taking the post office, the sheriff's station, the second iteration, and most of the citizens with it. The remaining families and businesses struggled on for a few months, but, as Harry had said, the town had been abandoned before the end of the year. He killed the Impala's engine, left the keys in the ignition. The sun hung above the horizon, but the air had cooled already. He punched his derby down on his head and slung his coat over his shoulder. It took him a few moments to orient himself, even though he'd been there just 3 months ago. The few black-tipped stubs to his left were the remains of the first time around. The bank's foundation still looked solid, as did two of the walls. A few steps past the bank gave him a view of the second iteration's stripped and sun-bleached husk. The wooden sidewalk's frame still stood, but all its planks had long since vanished. Eli wandered down Main Street, toward the vast plain where hundreds of cars had parked for one brief week over a century ago. He counted foundations where the houses had been stripped away by nature or scavengers. He reached the next intersection and smiled. Somehow, in the odd way of such things, the last paradox remained mostly whole. Only a dozen or so shingles sat up on the roof. The front railing had split at some point. One of the swinging doors had been claimed by history, but its twin still hung by rusted hinges. While the left-hand window had broken and been cleaned away at some point, the right-hand one sat with just a single crack to show the passage of time. The painted snake, its tail clutched in its mouth, had barely faded or flaked at all. He stared at the old saloon for almost 10 minutes. Eli reached out and set a hand on the dry railing. "I suppose it's my last visit," he said to nobody in particular. He went inside. Much like the outside, the interior of the last paradox had fared better than most. It was the ghost town saloon the television had prepared him for. 3 tables still stood, and twice as many chairs, but many of their brothers and sisters still lay where they'd fallen.
A spiderweb of cracks stretched across the bar's mirror, and a few squares and triangles of glass had fallen free. He counted half a dozen bottles, still shelved behind the bar. Dusty cobwebs draped the rafters and the metal loop that would have passed for a chandelier. He'd heard of spots like this, which had somehow escaped the worst of history and humanity. Abandoned for decades, but never looted or repurposed. Shelves still stocked, wood piles intact, coal buckets full. A pot sat on the battered stove in the corner. Plates, glasses, and bottles were scattered on the tables. He went back outside and walked the rest of Main Street. The road had been picked and kicked clean over the years. Old tire tracks from park vehicles decorated most of it. No nails or broken glass or other immediate hazards. Eli lined up the Impala. The engine rumbled between the old buildings. He watched the road for a ripple, a swirl in the dust, anything that stood out. The air sparkled, and he hit the gas. The Impala roared down Main Street and through a patch of sunlit dust. Eli muttered, took the car down to the edge of town, and turned around. He crawled back into Hourglass, his eyes glued to the road. A faint shimmer danced in the air, and the muscle car leaped forward again. The new tires gripped the dirt every inch of the way, never losing traction for a second as he blasted through the heat haze. He sighed and circled around at the big intersection, swerving past the remains of the first time around and the bank. The third time he drove the Impala at what turned out to be a swarm of gnats as they looped and spun and twisted across the road. The fourth time was another patch of dust. The fifth time, the setting sun hit a smear of gnat juice on the windshield and created a glow. Eli brought the Impala around again. He was running out of sunlight. Four, maybe five more runs, unless he wanted to keep trying in the dark. Something in the corner of his eye caught his attention. He slapped his foot down on the brakes. A heartbeat later, he killed the engine. Harry sat on the steps outside the last Paradox. Her frock coat sprawled open to show off a red vest and a baggy shirt, while her tricorn balanced on one knee. A brown bag sat next to her, along with a small drift of what looked like peanut shells. Her lips were pressed tightly together, but the corners of her mouth and eyes fluttered.
"Harry?" "Please," she said, waving him on. "Don't mind me, just continue making an ass of yourself."
She shook two nuts out of the shell and pushed them into her mouth, stifling a laugh. Eli got out of the Impala, dragging his coat after him, and walked over to her.
"How long have you been sitting there? How long have I been sitting here watching you drive up and down the road like a fool? Long enough that you'll be regretting it for some time to come."
She pulled another peanut from the bag and tore it open. Then she giggled and dropped it back in the bag.
"I waited for weeks and you didn't show up." "Well, I've been looking for you for months," she said, pushing herself up off the steps. "I showed up in Sanders, and everyone told me about how you'd bought a car and driven off into the sunset.
Once I realized I was going in and out of town with no problem, I figured it was safe for me to leave and come looking for you." He crossed his arms.
"Besides, how can you be late when you can travel through history?" "Not there," she said. "Not anymore. The closest slick spot to Sanders is down in Boston now. And it's almost a year off."
"That far?" She nodded.
"The best I could find was about 4 months after they let you go. Almost a third of them are gone. James thinks there may be a dozen or so new ones, but nobody's quite figured out where they are. And Eleanor was a wreck. I worked on her for a month, and that was with John's help."
They stood there for a moment. Harry knocked some dust from her tricorn. She examined the hat to make sure she hadn't missed any spots.
"So," said Eli.
He looked past her to the tavern.
"We made it to the last Paradox." "We did," said Harry. She pushed the hat up onto her head. "Thanks to you."
"I just got lucky. Put a few things together. You did all the work."
"We did it together then."
"Yeah." They looked at each other.
"So,"
he said. "Now what? There's no search? No dream to be had? What do we do now?" Harry's lips formed a soft, nervous smile.
"There's always a dream to be had."
"Yeah?"
"Yes."
He felt his own lips pull into the same awkward smile and felt a sudden need to check his boots for dust or dirt. Harry cleared her throat.
As I see it, there are two options in our immediate future.
Okay.
One, she said, jerking her thumb behind her, is there's a celebration going on here back in 1886.
Right here? She nodded.
Everyone who made it. About 36 of us. James is there. John's there chatting with Monica. Did you meet her?
Dark hair, wears a business suit.
That's her. Danny Cooper's with her. Alice Ramsey's come back for the end, and she's so old now. Maisie Wang was just heading in when I left.
When you left?
I had to go looking for my partner,
she said.
Who I might note is not smart enough to just stay at home where I can find him.
Sorry.
You should be. Dumb luck I found you here.
I think I found you.
Don't nitpick Mr. Teague,
she overemphasized his name. So, option one is a party. Harry nodded.
And they're all waiting for you.
Me?
Us, technically. We are the ones who found the dream.
Ah. What's option two? She looked at her own boots.
I've been driving around America for a while now. I was thinking it was time to try somewhere new. Maybe Canada or Cuba.
There aren't any roads to Cuba. Harry looked up at him.
Not yet,
she said.
But I happen to know a shortcut, if you don't feel like waiting.
She blinked twice and met his gaze again. Well, said Eli, is there any reason we can't do both?
None at all.
She reached out, then pulled her hands back.
Eleanor's just around the corner. Do you have everything?
Eli looked down at the coat, hooked on his fingers. He felt the brim of his hat against his head. He glanced back at the Impala and imagined a park ranger finding the muscle car in the center of town in a few days, still with half a tank of gas and the keys in the ignition. Yeah, he said. I've got everything I need. The corners of her mouth twitched, and her lips stretched a little wider across her face. She leaned forward, brought her face close to his, and then settled back on her heels.
Okay, then. Let's go.
They stepped off the stairs of the Last Paradox together.
Oh, she added. One thing.
Yeah?
If this is going to be a permanent arrangement, I'm going to need you to chip in for fuel.
I'm sure we'll work out something, Eli said.
I'm sure we will.
Afterword. This is the longest I've ever spent on a book. Okay, that's kind of a lie. Not a great way to start this. It's the longest I've ever spent on a published book. My actual first novel, never before seen, with good reason, took me almost 9 years to finish, depending on how you want to count it, and then another 3 years to edit. Since I've started doing this full-time, though, yeah, this has been the longest. It's also been very odd writing a book about the United States and the American dream as all of 2016 and the first few months of 2017 have rolled by. Things I worried were a bit too dark now feel almost cartoonishly simple. Things that started out feeling a bit optimistic have come to feel almost hopelessly naive. Then again, nobody seems to be getting tired of watching movies about Captain America. As always, I'm both thrilled and stunned some of you decided to pick up my latest tome. Even more surprised you've made it all the way to the back and are reading the afterword, hoping to glean some more fun facts about the people and things and situations I made up this time. Of course, this time, I didn't make all of it up. For example, James Dean was an American film icon, nominated for 2 posthumous Academy Awards, who absolutely loved automobiles. In fact, he considered giving up Hollywood to devote more time to racing. His death in an automobile accident was far too well documented to be a hoax, but it's nice to dream. Alice Ramsey was the first woman to drive across the United States in 1909, and the third person to ever do it. At age 22, she took 3 friends from New York City to San Francisco in a brand new Maxwell touring car, setting a new cross-country record in the process. She repeated the trip numerous times during her very long life and would often be away on the road for weeks at a time. Henry Frank Hawkins was one of the original minor 49ers rushing out to California from Maine at the age of 14. He made several successful trips out west, trying different routes and finally settled in New Orleans, although he still visited Maine from time to time. It's probably also worth mentioning that he's my great-great-grandfather. Many of the cross-country oddities mentioned in this book, the town of Dinosaur, the Wrong Soldier statue in York, Maine, Pasadena's Fork in the Road, Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop Bar in New Orleans, are all real, and you can visit all of them. But, yeah, I did make up some of it. The town of Hourglass, alas, is pure fiction. So is Harry's hometown of Shame. But we may still need to visit it someday just to find out exactly why her parents left. Sanders, Maine is also fiction, but the Founder's House is loosely inspired by the old Ocean House Hotel, which stood on a hill in York Beach for almost 130 years before being torn down in 1985. I also tweaked history a bit. There were a few times and places where I needed things to happen. Or to have happened, as is the way with time travel. If you didn't notice them, don't worry. If you did, I meant to do that. Really. And of course, there are a lot of folks who helped me with this in one way or another and deserve a bunch of thanks. First off, all of you following me on Twitter or Facebook who put up with my constant vague hints and refusal to tell you anything useful. I have to assume you're sticking around for all the geeky nonsense. Ed and Alex educated me on the fine differences between bourbon and rye whiskey. Ray and Beau both offered helpful tips and insights about classic cars. Dennis, my dad, helped me with some railroad history. Mary talked to me about wounds and injuries, plus some cutting-edge medical stuff that might be boringly common in a decade or so. CD, David, and John all read early versions of this book, caught many problems, and offered many suggestions. CD and Christy went through a later version of it, too. David, my agent, championed this book when it wasn't much more than 3 pages of notes and something we'd talked about over drinks at San Diego Comic-Con. Julian, my editor, continued to believe in it, even after the completely crazy everything-but-the-kitchen-sink-it-got-away-from-me, yeah, draft I first handed him. And as always, so many thanks to my lovely lady, Collie, who puts up with so many random, rambling discussions and segues about train tracks, 1850s coinage, time paradoxes, plus all the usual moaning and self-doubt. I'm still not sure why she puts up with it, but I think it's good for all of us that she does. Peter Kleins, Los Angeles, March 2017.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Paradox Bound, a novel, written by Peter Kleins, performed by Ray Porter. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by Peter Kleins. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.